Dr. Bart Ehrman, how are you?
Yes, I'm well, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Although I believe that most people already know you, but can you please introduce yourself for my audience?
So I'm Bart Ehrman. I teach at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. My area of expertise is the New Testament and early Christianity. I write books and blog posts and all sorts of things about Christianity from the time of Jesus up through about the fourth Christian century.
So at times of recording, it's still 7th of January, so it's not way past your last course, the Dark Christmas course. How was your Dark Christmas course?
I enjoyed it a lot. You know, I came up with the idea when I was just thinking hard about the stories of Jesus' birth in Matthew and Luke, were the only two places where you have them in the New Testament. And I've always puzzled about why does Herod have to kill the children in Bethlehem in order for Jesus to come into the world? I mean, in Matthew, Herod kills all the boys 2 years and under in Bethlehem, and it's in order to fulfill the scriptures. Well, why did God prophesy that was going to happen? I mean, why didn't he just let Jesus come into the world without killing anybody for it? And so it made me start thinking that throughout the Matthew and Luke both, there are these stories about the nativity scene that actually are pretty troubling. And so the course was about that. So it was a two-lecture course and talking about the difficulties of Matthew and Luke, where people are used to thinking of them in very joyful terms, which makes sense. But also there's a real dark side and questioning why does there have to be a dark side to the coming of Jesus into the world?
So I haven't attended the course because, you know, I have to adjust my financial strategy, but I'm planning to join it maybe in the future. But I already watched your podcast with Alex O'Connor. You're talking about Herod. In one session, you're talking about why did Herod have to kill all the babies? My question is, Herod, and I'm sorry if I sound ignorant, Herod is a real historical figure, right?
Oh, yeah. We know a lot about him. He's discussed in the writings of the first century historian Josephus. We actually have his tomb. Just in recent years, they've discovered his tomb. And he was absolutely a historical figure.
Okay, so about the killing of the babies, is that a historical event too?
I don't think so. It's okay. Recorded. I mean, the only place we hear about it is in the Gospel of Matthew. But there's no reference to it in any other ancient source. Josephus, who talks a lot about Herod, doesn't say anything about that. And it looks like what's happened is that either Matthew or whoever he heard this story from was trying to show that Jesus, when he came into the world, was fulfilling scripture. And Matthew quotes a passage from the book of Jeremiah about Rachel weeping for her children because there were no more. And this was, he said, to be fulfilled with the coming of Jesus. And so it looks like the story was invented in order to explain that Jesus is the Messiah in fulfilling this prophecy from Jeremiah.
Yeah, so my point is, I believe that most people now, because of the gospel, believe that Herod did slaughter a lot of children, and that makes Herod somehow become the world's most slandered historical figure. Don't you think so?
Well, I wouldn't say he's the most slandered, but he's certainly slandered, and for that. But you know, he did a lot of good things. Herod, I mean, the historical Herod, had engaged in a lot of building projects in Israel and that employed a lot of people and built a lot of amazing places. And he did good things for the people of Israel, but he also did some rather horrible things. And this one, I don't think he actually did, but he does have kind of a mixed reputation.
Because of the writings of in the gospel, right? I mean, of course, there's no perfect historical figure. There are people who do good things and bad things, but to remember a person for something that they did not do, I think it's a very bad reputation for him, and it's clearly unjustified. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's unjustified to think that he slaughtered the innocent babies, but we have a pretty good record of the things he did. And so, you know, his reputation has to be based on what we know about him. And so if anybody wants to know about him, all they have to do is, I mean, I guess it's maybe not that easy to get the writings of Josephus, but you can get them online. And he says, you know, he says a bit about Herod. He was, you know, he was king for about 40 years, and he was closely tied to the Roman government back in Rome. He was involved back in the days of Julius Caesar and you know, Cleopatra and all of that. And so we have a pretty good record of the things he said and did. So if people are sort of opposed to him because of the slaughter of the innocents in Bethlehem, that's not a very good reason, because that probably didn't happen. But you can find out other things about him from the historical record.
Okay. About your courses, you made a lot of courses I don't keep the record, but what is your favorite courses that you've made so far?
Well, you know, so I started this company about 2 years ago, about 3 years ago now, I guess, that where we record courses. Some of them are just, you know, like a two-lecture thing, which is what the Dark Side of Christianity was. More commonly, they've been eight-lecture courses where I'll do four lectures on a Saturday and then four on a Sunday. And so there'll be eight lectures of 50 minutes with a Q&A at the end of each day. Those are a lot of fun to do. And I've done a lot of them on various topics, including a number of biblical books. I did my favorite one for the Old Testament is I did one on the book of Genesis. That was just a really great fun to do, the lectures on Genesis. The New Testament, I've done a number of them as well, including one that I really liked from the Gospel of Mark, which I think is a gospel that is my favorite gospel. And it's a gospel that I think is widely misunderstood by people, and people don't think very much of it. They don't tend to like it as much as John or Matthew, but I think it's a fantastic gospel, and I try to explain why in this course. And so those are two of the lectures I've done, two of the courses I've done that I think are for me were particularly interesting.
Okay, next question. How does it feel to be a world superstar in the world of New Testament scholarship?
I don't know. You need to ask somebody. I mean, I've written a lot of books, and I've done these courses and things. And, you know, I also have a blog that I really am proud of, where I post five times a week on the blog. And we have a large following for this blog. People have to pay a little bit to belong to the blog, but it's not much. It's like, you know, a dime a week or something. But we raise money for charity. And I think for all the things I do, it's the thing I'm most proud of. This last year, on this blog, just from people paying this little membership fee, we have enough people that this last year we raised $575,000 for charities dealing with hunger and homelessness. And so it's just called the Bart Ehrman blog. And so, you know, if my reputation helps to raise money for charity, that's great. Good. I'm all for it.
Are you aware of your online popularity, and how does it affect you? Do you feel a constant burden to always, you know, get things right because of that?
Well, you know, I think scholars always want to get things right. I mean, so, you know, I started studying the Bible seriously, over 50 years ago. And I spent the last 50 years doing research on issues connected with the New Testament, early Christianity, the Old Testament. You know, just to do a PhD in that area of New Testament studies, you have to learn ancient Greek and ancient Hebrew and Latin. You have to be able to read French. You have to be able to read German. It's a long time just to be able to get ready to do the study. And so I've worked at this stuff for, you know, over 50 years now. And so I try to get things right, but of course nobody gets everything right. And there's also, you know, people have different opinions about things and different scholarly judgments about things. But I do try to, when I present my scholarship, either in my courses or on my blog or teaching at my university, at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, you know, I try to make sure that I get the fact right, just because I think that's, you know, that's why I'm here. That's what I do for a living.
Have you ever envisioned becoming an online scholar like you do now? Online scholar in the sense of YouTube online scholar, something like that.
What's the question about it?
Have you ever seeing yourself back maybe like 10 years from 10 years back? Have you ever envisioned yourself?
You know, I that was never my ambition. When I did my training, when I did my PhD, my real interest had to do with a very technical area that most people don't even know about within New Testament studies. It had to do with trying to analyze all of the Greek manuscripts of the New Testament that we have to see what their differences and similarities are to help us classify these various manuscripts. And so it's a very technical area. And I wanted to do that for my life. I wanted to just work with ancient Greek manuscripts. And so it's not the sort of thing that anybody would be interested in except for real scholars in the field. But what ended up happening is I wrote a few books about that. And then I got invited to write a textbook for undergraduate students on the New Testament, which is generally on the New Testament. And I was reluctant to do it because I was just interested in studying this technical field of mine. But I decided to do it because I really liked teaching. And so I wrote this textbook, and it became a very popular textbook in the English-speaking world. And that was, you know, that was like in 1997, and so like 27 years ago. And it's still, we just put out the 8th edition of it. That got me kind of interested in communicating with people other than scholars. The textbook was written for college students, but then I started writing books for lay people. And so books that representing scholarship, but in terms that lay people could understand. And that's what a lot of what I do now. And I didn't anticipate that it would lead to, you know, having this kind of success online and things, but it has. And that's good because it just, you know, it's, I mean, you know, for me, it doesn't, I, you know, I don't care. I mean, it's not like, I mean, for in terms of my personal thing, I mean, it's not like, you know, it's just that it's, you know, it gets the information out there that people really need to hear about the New Testament and early Christianity. And so any way I can do that, I'm, you know, I'm willing to do it.
What's the difference between teaching lay people and teaching in universities?
Well, so there are actually three audiences that I try to reach, three different audiences. One audience are my fellow scholars. And so I write books for scholars that most lay people would not be interested in because they presuppose a lot of information already, a lot of background knowledge. They presuppose the ability to read Greek, ancient Greek. They presuppose a lot of jargon. And so as scholars, we're trained to communicate with scholars. So that's one of my audiences. Another audience is my university students. So these tend to be 19 and 20-year-old students who, you know, are from America mainly, not all, but mainly. Most of them tend to have been raised in Christian circles. And I'm communicating to them like you communicate to a 19 and 20-year-old, which is not the way I communicate to scholars, because the scholars have all sorts of knowledge that these students don't yet. So those are two of the audiences. But then the third audience I try to communicate with are adults who are simply interested in the kind of material that I'm dealing with, interested in what historians have to say about the Bible and early Christianity and the historical Jesus, not from the perspective of faith, but from the perspective of history and the perspective of literature and how scholars have studied Jesus and the New Testament and early Christianity from these historical perspectives. So the thing is that for each of these audiences, the scholars, the undergraduate students at university, the adults, there's different ways to communicate to all three of them. And so I try to do that. And I would say that my online presence is really more attributed to the adults, more than the students and more than the scholars.
How does it affect you when teaching universities regarding your online courses and then your online presence? Does it affect the way you teach or does it drain you off excitement? Because you think YouTube is much more fun?
No, well, I'll tell you, it's just a different thing. I really like teaching undergraduate students in university. And so my classes start tomorrow. I'm really pumped up, really excited about it. But I don't, you know, the fact that I do all this online stuff doesn't really affect how I teach my classes. Sometimes my students will know about me from my online presence, but it's more common that their parents know about me than they do, because they're busy playing computer games or something. They're not watching my YouTube channel or something. So it hasn't changed how I teach, but it does mean that I have a new audience as well as my undergraduate students.
Have you ever encountered one of your students that when he sees you for the first time, he's like geeked out, like, oh my God, this is Bart Ehrman or something? Have you ever experienced that?
Yeah, they do that sometimes. And it's like, they'll ask me for an autograph for their parents, or they'll ask me to autograph a book or something. And sometimes, students take my class even though they were raised in the church and their pastors told them, don't take Ehrman's class and don't do it. And they'll take the class anyway. And so that actually happens with a lot of my students now. And they take the class, they realize, actually, this is not crazy stuff at all. This is just scholarship, and it's I don't ever require anybody to agree with me on anything. I don't make them change their minds about their religion or their faith or about what they think about the Bible. But I do present in my classes, it's a non-religious school. It's a secular university. It's not a church. It's not a Sunday school. And so we approach things from a historical perspective. And most of the students have never heard this kind of thing before, because the only times they've ever talked about the Bible or religion is in church. And there you're with fellow believers, and you're trying to promote each other's faith, and it just isn't like that in the university. So they do, a lot of them do know about my reputation, but every now and then someone gets a little bit gushy, but not that often, luckily.
why are you so threatening against the religious, especially the Christians?
Well, I'm not threatening to a lot of Christians, because the kinds of things I teach about the historical Jesus, like when I said that Herod probably did not really kill the babies the way Matthew says he did, for many Christians, that would be really offensive or hard to understand, because they were raised in churches where they thought the Bible had no mistakes in it and everything it says is completely accurate. And so, for them, that can be a problem, and we have to kind of talk about why it's a problem and how to deal with it if you keep your faith, but you realize the Bible has problems. But, I learned that material when I was going to seminary, being trained to be a minister. In high-level seminary, like my seminary, I went to Princeton Theological Seminary, which is in New Jersey. It's a Presbyterian seminary. It trains Presbyterian ministers. Basically, all my friends from then went into ministry, and they took the same classes I took. and we learned these things in my classes. Most of my former friends, or my friends, I guess, they don't teach this stuff in their churches, but they know this stuff. And so people can find it a little bit shocking, but in part it's shocking because their pastors don't teach it to them. I'm not working out of a church. I'm working out of a university. And so I'm quite happy to talk about historical scholarship, not in order to make people disbelieve at all. But if they do revere the Bible, if they respect the Bible, if they like the Bible, they ought to know something about it. And it doesn't have to change their faith, but it should change the way they actually think about this book that they take so seriously.
Okay. You said earlier that Christians, maybe some of them, not most of them, would get offended when we say that Herod did not kill the babies because they came from Christian faith. So saying that is like saying that the Gospels got wrong in its historical assertions. But to me, as a non-Christian and never been one for my entire life, I came from a Sufi kind of belief. which has almost no relation with the kind of Christianity like we know now. I think to say that people believe that Herod kills all the babies, it's much more offensive because people believe something that someone didn't do. And since that we can clearly know that Herod is was a real figure, to say that he did something by the book that it's not historical, and then people just believe that, I think that's much more offensive to me. At least to my own opinion, because I never see much of my friend that came from the same kind of belief would get offended by things like that. But killing babies, it's not a light kind of bad things to do, I guess. We got back to the first kind of first questions I asked. I'm trying to ask you this this. Sorry if I'm stutter because I actually kind of geeked out too. You know, I'm a big fan of yours. I'm a big fan of you. but my question: have you ever been invited to a conversation like this, or maybe a seminar like this, which most of the audiences are not from Christianity or even not from the Abrahamic religion?
I've done a number of interviews with Muslim interviewers who are mainly catering to Muslim audiences, and I've done a number of speaking engagements and a number of interviews with people who are Jewish, who are not Christian. I don't recall ever doing anything with anyone from something that was not an Abrahamic religion. The Abrahamic religions would be Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And I don't recall being interviewed by somebody other than people who are atheists. I get interviewed a lot by atheists. I guess that counts. But no. So, you know, I think with Islam, it's the understanding of Christianity would be very different from somebody outside the faith. And you know, Muslims generally have a different kind of understanding about Jesus and the New Testament from Christians. But my point initially that I didn't make very well is that there's a lot more diversity within Christianity than people recognize. So that my two closest friends are Presbyterian ministers. They're actually ministers of churches, and they basically agree with my views about the Bible. I mean, they agree with them. So they're still Christian, but they're not fundamentalist Christians, you know, or they're not conservative evangelical Christians. And so I think within Christianity, more than in Islam, there's been historical scholarship that has called into question the claims of the Bible, much more than there have been Islamic scholars calling into question the claims of the Quran.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I often also see people debunking you online. I guess it's natural for you because given your popularity. I want to ask you this: which one is more tiring for you, being constantly debunked or maybe misrepresented or online, or accused by Christians for luring their believer out of their faith?
You know, I don't pay much attention to people who are trying to debunk me. I mean, I don't read them or anything. I mean, I know their arguments because the views that most people are trying to debunk me are conservative Christians, usually Protestants, evangelical Christians, who understand the Bible in the way that I used to understand it. So I know these views very well. I went to a very conservative evangelical Bible college out when I left high school, and I was absolutely trained in evangelical ways of thinking about the Bible and theology and the church and everything else. So whenever they come up with some argument against what I say, it's almost always something that I used to think. So, like, it's not a surprise to me. I mean, yeah, okay, I could have made that argument. I get it, but I just don't find it convincing because now, since I've looked at the evidence, I see it the other way. I do, so I don't mind people having alternative, you know, understandings of things. That's fine. I do get upset, I think, when people are dishonest about it. I think it's very strange how many conservative evangelicals who attack me are, they sometimes just tell lies. Or they say things that just aren't true that they should know, including in writing, you know, about me personally. Well, they'll say something about my life or something that I've said or something that I believe that is just wrong. And sometimes, I mean, it's even happened with friends of mine who are evangelicals who've written books and said something about me. It's just wrong. I mean, I'll give you an example. I won't name the name, but a well-known evangelical Christian scholar, a New Testament scholar whom I've known for many years, wrote in a book once that the reason I left Christianity was because I came to realize that of our many manuscripts of the New Testament, there were lots of changes in them, lots of differences in them. And that once I realized there were differences in our manuscripts, it made me lose my faith in the Bible and to become a non-Christian. And that's crazy. Of course, that's not what led me to leave Christianity. I knew there were all these changes in the Bible when I was a fundamentalist Christian. So I actually called him up. I said, "What are you talking about? That's not why I left Christianity. Why do you? All you had to do is ask me." And so, you know, and then sometimes, like, I'll be in some debate and with somebody, and they'll just start making stuff up. And it just, you know, my view is that. You know, if we're going to disagree, then at least you should be factual in what you say instead of just making stuff up in order to win a debate. You know, and these evangelicals are the ones who are supposed to believe in the truth. Well, if you believe in the truth, then you should tell the truth a little bit more. So that does upset me. I think it's also, I find it a little bit upsetting when people say that I try to deconvert people from Christianity. That I tried to lead them away from the faith. Nothing could be farther from the truth. And people have said this to me publicly. They've said it in public settings. I've been in debates where a person that I know, he's a conservative evangelical, will swear that I say in my undergraduate classes that my point is to try and get them to leave Christianity. And it's absolutely false. And I said, look, you can ask any of my students. Every semester I say, this is not what I'm interested in doing. You can believe whatever you want to believe. You can, I'm not interested in changing your beliefs. I'm interested in you learning something about history. And whatever you do with that, with your faith, is your issue. But I absolutely am not trying to make people to leave the faith. As I say, many of my best friends are Christians. Why would I want them to leave their faith? Just because I don't agree with them or don't believe it. And so, yeah, I do find those things a little bit irritating. But I think people should just do their homework a little bit more before they talk about somebody in public.
Okay, let's talk about something a little bit lighter. Do you have any favorite scholars you'd like to invite to your channel in the future? Who and what do you think the topics will be?
So I've got several things going on. So when you say channel, do you mean my YouTube channel or
YouTube channel?
My YouTube channel. Because, you know, I do this podcast. And so I don't know if your listeners know about this podcast. It's just called Misquoting Jesus. Mm-hmm. That was the title of one of my books, Misquoting Jesus. And so it's Misquoting Jesus with Bart Ehrman. And it's a weekly podcast. I get interviewed by a very fine scholar and interesting person, Megan Lewis, who was a scholar of the ancient Near East. And so, like, she's an expert in ancient languages like Akkadian and Ugaritic and stuff, but she's really interesting, and she interviews me every week. But then every now and then we'll have somebody else come on the show to be interviewed by her. And just today or yesterday, the podcast came out with a colleague of mine, Hugo Mendez, who gave a really interesting interview about a course that he's going to do for us for my courses online. He's going to do a full semester-long course on the New Testament, an introduction to the New Testament it'd be like a university course that people can just, they can purchase and get on and see it. And so So I really like having these other the other scholars. What I often do, we'll have scholars on who've written an interesting book that is for lay people, and I'll interview them about it, about their book. And so I'm sure I'll be doing more of those down the line.
Do you have any favorite history YouTuber?
You know, I don't watch YouTube. I don't read blogs. You know, I've written one every day for over 12 years. I've five times a week I publish it, but I don't read blogs. I don't watch YouTube. I just don't have time. I'm always doing my own research and writing and speaking engagements and interviews. And so I don't have time. I don't even have time to watch TV. He's like, I've got no, I don't have a favorite YouTuber. I've been on some channels that I really like. You know, I mean, some of my favorite interviewers who've interviewed me, Sam Harris is really great. There's a thing called Fresh Air, a radio show called Fresh Air with Terry Gross, who's an amazing interviewer. And so, but you know, I've done a lot of YouTube channel interviews, and most of them are good.
What do you think about history YouTubers like MythVision or Paulo Gia? Do you have any opinion on them? I'm a fan of them too.
Apologia, that's Paul Enns.
Paulo Gia and Derek Lambert of MythVision.
Yeah. No, I'm friends with both of them. Yeah. They're both doing really good work, and so they, you know, they're very different in their personalities and in the way they approach things. Derek studies very hard in order to learn a lot about what he's interviewing on for his MythVision thing. I think that he started out really being mainly interested in the idea that Jesus was not a real person, but was a myth. And I think that's a dead end. I don't think that's going to get anywhere. But that's what he started with. But now he's become kind of really knowledgeable about a lot of things. And Paul Enns, who does Apologia, is really bright. And he has a similar background to mine, where he was a conservative evangelical Christian who memorized books of the Bible and was like that. But then he left. And his interviews are always interesting with me because he... rather than you kind of ask me questions the way you're doing, what he does often is he'll have somebody who's been debunking me that I didn't know about, that he'll play like a segment of this person saying something and ask me what I think about it. And usually I'm just rolling my eyes and saying, oh my God, you got to be kidding me. Really? That's nuts. So, yeah.
Okay. So, my original, my original passion is actually about philosophy. So I deconverted back then in 2019, and I tried to catch up with all of my years of not learning anything about the history of religion by watching a lot of YouTube videos, because many of their scholarly books didn't available in Indonesia back then. And then I came across with MythVision and Paulo Gia, and I learned a lot about history from them. And even up until today, I still use them mainly for my references. Yeah, this is more like a subjective take, a subjective question from my part. But do you think their contents, or maybe another contents, YouTubers like them, could be used as a good reference if we want to make some historical contents in YouTube, not as a scholar? What do you think?
I think it's hard to say, because it's you know, the best way to learn scholarship is to read scholars. And you can get a lot of scholarship online, so you don't need to have a big library or anything. And the best way to become knowledgeable about a field is by reading what scholars say about it, rather than what people who do interviews say about it. And so both of them are interviewing scholars. And I think the thing to do is to figure out which of these scholars sound most reputable to you, and try to read some of their stuff, or do, I don't know, if you have access to Audible books, for example, or if you just can get books online, maybe, or articles. But there are a lot of really, I mean, there are thousands of New Testament scholars, and some are just, you know, better than others. There are some who are just absolutely superb, and they're good ones to read, depending on what your particular interest in religion generally, or Christianity, or whatever.
What makes a scholar better than the other, especially in the field of New Testament?
Knowledge. Some people know a lot more than others. New Testament is a tricky field. It doesn't seem like it should be hard, right? It's mm-hmm. just the New Testament. How hard can it be? Just read the thing. Yeah. It seems like that. It's not that way at all. To really understand the New Testament, you have to read it in Greek. You have to read it. You have to be really good at Greek. You have to know what scholars have said about interpretation issues. You have to know about the history of scholarship. You need breadth of knowledge. You really, ideally, to be a really good New Testament scholar, you have to know a lot about the Roman Empire, the Greek and Roman worlds, Greek and Roman philosophy. You need to know about Judaism. You need to know about the Hebrew Bible, the history of ancient Israel, but you also need to know about Judaism in the time of Jesus. You need to know about what happened in Christianity after the New Testament period. You have to be trained in literary analysis. You need to have a lot of historical information about historical context. And so there are some, it's just a reality, there's some scholars who know more things than others. It's like any other field. I mean, you can have a physicist or you can have Einstein, and Einstein was better. So it's true in any academic field that there are some people who are really very, very solid, and other people who are fine, and other people are not so good. But so you have to be able to evaluate who's who. And then you want to read the ones who are really known to be very reputable scholars.
What do you think is the hardest part of learning New Testament?
Well, for most people, the hardest thing is learning the Greek. Yeah. So the thing is that you can't really just isolate one thing that's hard, because it's hard up and down the line, because it's the New Testament was written 2,000 years ago by people living not just writing in a different language and not just living like in a different part of the world, but the entire way of understanding the world was different 2,000 years ago. And we bring a lot of assumptions to something when we read it. We assume that people all think alike, and that when we read a word, we know what it means. And it might not even mean the same thing to somebody else. And it's very hard to translate the New Testament into a modern language, English or any other modern language. And it's hard to interpret the New Testament because it's written in a different world and by people that we don't have access to ask what they meant by that. And so it really is a difficult thing. It doesn't seem like it should be, but I've done it for 50 years and I'm a reasonably smart guy. And there's a lot of stuff that I simply don't know. And that's after studying it for 50 years.
What is the craziest idea ever proposed by scholars like you regarding the New Testament that you find it's so outrageous, but at the same time, very reasonable?
Huh. Well, I don't know. For me, if it's reasonable, it's not so outrageous. there are a lot of ideas that I think are pretty outrageous that have no way of being right. The idea that Jesus didn't exist, I just think I think that's a non-starter, but there's a kind of a growing audience of people online who are mythicists who think that Jesus didn't exist, and I think that goes nowhere. But I don't think it's a credible idea, so it's not really I don't think it's a particularly reasonable idea. The thing is that serious scholarship, like when people publish books with reputable publishing houses, like if somebody published a book with Oxford University Press or Princeton University Press or one of these presses, to get a book published in a venue like that means that you've got to have other people who are very serious scholars agree that this is worth publishing. And if somebody publishes like their own book, which is great, I think people should publish their own books if they want to, but you don't know whether that, like if you're reading books, right, and you've got two books, you've got one book that's published by Oxford University Press, you got another that somebody published by him or herself, you just don't know about the him or herself if you're not an expert. If you got something from Oxford Press, it may be wrong. The book may be wrong, but it's serious scholarship because it wouldn't get published otherwise. And so I think it's like that in every field, probably. But so if you're trying to learn more about the New Testament, the thing to do is to read books that are published by reputable presses and by scholars who are acknowledged by everybody as being good scholars. And there are people like that. There are people who everybody says, yeah, that's a good scholar.
What are the arguments that the Jesus mythicists have?
There are a lot of things they argue that are absolutely true, but don't lead to their conclusion. Mm-hmm. They point out that the Gospels are written decades after Jesus would have lived if he lived, that the Gospels disagree with one another, that Paul doesn't seem to know very much about the historical Jesus, that there are contradictions in the Gospels and that kind of thing, that the idea that Jesus was God was a later development, and that that all is true, and they say, well, you know, these sources are so contradictory to each other that they can't be saying anything that's true. So they've got a lot of arguments. I mean, they've got, you know, there are books on this thing written by those kinds of people. I have a book that attacks this view. I've got a book that's just called Did Jesus Exist, where I explain what the mythicists say and then show why I don't agree with it and why, like, no other scholar agrees with it. But, I mean, no, that's not quite true. There are scholars who agree with it, but they're not. I don't personally know any New Testament scholar of the hundreds and thousands I know who think it could be right. That doesn't mean they're wrong. I mean, the fact scholars say something doesn't make it right. You know, but it does mean the people who study this thing for decade after decade just don't give much credence to it. And it's because there's so much evidence that Jesus did exist. And so you just have to look at the evidence and you make a decision then.
Okay, let's talk about another topic. What does Christianity mean to you now? How do you describe your relationship with that religion?
I resonate with a good deal of Christianity. I think that the teachings of Jesus in many ways are important. I think he was mistaken about important things. I think he really did think that there was going to be a day of judgment coming within his time, and that God was going to destroy everything that was evil, and God was going to bring people into a new kingdom where there'd be a kind of a paradise. I think Jesus thought that was going to happen in his lifetime, and it didn't happen. So I think he's wrong about that. But I do think that his teachings, that it really matters how we treat one another, that that's the most important thing, and that we take care of those who are in need, that that's the most important thing. I agree with those teachings. But I don't think that Jesus himself was a divine being. I don't think that he was raised from the dead, or born of a virgin. So I'm not a Christian because I don't believe in kind of what it normally means to be a Christian. But I do accept the teaching, many of the teachings of Jesus, and I think that they're important for us. And so I have no desire to make somebody stop being a Christian. I do have a desire to stop people from being fundamentalists of every kind, because fundamentalists, I think, create problems for our world and create a lot of suffering. Fundamentalist Christians certainly do, with their views of sex and sexuality and gay rights and LGBTQ issues and women and like all sorts of things. But I think, fundamentalist Jews are also really problematic for the world, and fundamentalist Muslims. I mean, fundamentalists are a problem. and so I think that I am opposed to fundamentalism in all its forms, but I'm not opposed to somebody being Muslim or somebody being Jewish, somebody being Christian or somebody being agnostic or atheist. My view is that if they're not hurting anybody, it's great. And if you're helping people, it's even better. And you're not helping people when you hurt them. So stop hurting them. So it's kind of a simple view, but that's so, yeah.
So how does the God of the New Testament differ from the new one? The God of the Old Testament differ from the new one? Because there are some passages in the Old Testament that I think personally contradictory with the new one.
Yeah. Well, you know what people always say that I think is a little bit too simple, but the common line is that the God of the Old Testament is a God of wrath, and the God of the New Testament is a God of love. And so that's, at least in America, that's like this common line you hear all the time. And I think it's really too simple because the God of the Old Testament is also a God of love. The idea you should love your neighbor as yourself is in the Old Testament. That's one of the commandments of the law of Moses, you know, and you should love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and strength. That's in the law of Moses. And God loves his people Israel, and he's trying to do the best for them. And so God is a God of love in the Old Testament, but he's also a God of wrath. When people disobey him, he punishes them. But when you get to the New Testament, yes, God is a God of love in the New Testament, but he's also a God of wrath. I mean, the book of Revelation, the last book of the New Testament, is all about the wrath of God. When God destroys the world and virtually everybody in it in horrible ways because they've disobeyed him. And so it isn't that like you've got one picture in the Old Testament and a different picture in the New Testament. You get various pictures in different parts of the Old Testament, various parts of the New Testament. And in all the pictures, God is both a God of love and a God of wrath.
Do you have any ideal conception of what a God should be? This is kind of like a philosophical, theological question, but maybe you have some thoughts.
Well, I would, if there were a God, I think I'd prefer a God who didn't allow suffering in the world, who didn't bring earthquakes and volcanoes and tsunamis and drought and famine. We live in a world where people suffer horribly. And so this is the reason I left Christianity, actually. I got to a point where I didn't believe that the Christian God, as I had been taught he was, I don't think there can be that kind of God in the world. I don't see how I can be a monotheist, because I think that the world is such a wretched place. And, you know, people have all sorts of explanations for why they're suffering in the world. And I know these explanations. I mean, I know them quite well. It's true that humans themselves cause a lot of suffering. It's not God's fault. That's true. But on the other hand, God did make us the way we are. And God does, I mean, and the world, it's not just people hurting people. Hurricanes are hurting people. Humans aren't at fault for that. And so there are a lot of explanations for it. I don't personally think any of the explanations works, or that they all work together somehow. And when I got to that point is when I decided to leave Christianity. I have a book that deals with this. I've got a book called God's Problem, How the Bible Fails to Answer Our Most Important Question, Why We Suffer. And there I talk about all the views in the Bible about why we suffer. And I get more into the philosophical side of it as well. Because as you know, the philosophers have said a lot about the problem of suffering in the Western world, especially since the Enlightenment. And so, you know, since the 18th century, it's been a bit of an obsession among philosophers in the West. And of course, in Eastern traditions, there are other ways of dealing with suffering as well, especially Buddhism and such. But there you don't have the problem with monotheism. The problem with monotheism is you've got one almighty God who created everything and is good and is also loving. It's kind of hard to explain why there's so much suffering if he's able to solve the problem and doesn't.
I actually have asked almost all the questions and we still have like 10 minutes left. So we have 13 hour differences here, because
right. So we would, yeah.
So just trivial things. In Indonesia now it's already 9th of January. I believe in yours is still 8th. So there's a huge time difference here. And while you're using sweater to make yourself warm, I'm here sweating profusely because it's too hot here.
I have a fire in my fireplace. It's cold here.
We still have four minutes. Before the last question, I want to, have you ever heard anything about Indonesia, or maybe you're familiar with Indonesian in any way?
My wife lived there when she was a child.
Oh.
When she was young, very, very young. Her father worked for Shell Oil and was traveling around the world, and she happened to live there for a couple of years. But I've never been, and I've always wanted to come. And so we've talked about visiting the various places she lived in. She's born in Venezuela. She lived in Indonesia. She lived in Thailand. And I haven't been to any of those places. And so we may do that sometime.
Yeah, do let me know if you come. Who knows that I can see you and then ask for your autographs for most of the books.
That's right.
But most of my books are audible, so I cannot ask you for physical.
Hard to sign those, yeah.
maybe one of my shirts. Okay, so yeah, the last questions for you, Bart. In your career as a scholar, have you ever been fatally mistaken about something? About what, and how do you correct the mistakes you made?
Have I ever been
mistaken about something?
Yeah, well, I've been mistaken about lots of things. And so that's the life. You know, I think there are some people who think certain things. They've thought these things since they were 12 years old, and they think them their entire lives, and they never change their minds. And I think that's crazy. You know, of course, in my personal life, I've really changed in terms of my religious views. But in terms of scholarship, I'm always open to changing my mind if there's evidence to lead me that way. And so any issue, I mean, even was Jesus a myth? I'm open to the arguments, you know, but if they're not any good, I just say I don't think they're any good. But sometimes, of course, I change my mind about all sorts of things. And in my book, sometimes I will have said something 30 years ago in a book that I wrote that I disagree with now. And, you know, for a long time, I thought that Matthew, Mark, and Luke did not understand Jesus to be God. And I disagree with that. I think they did think he was God in some way. And so I change my whenever, it, you know, and so it happens. It happens to me whenever I find the evidence compelling.
I see. Bart Ehrman, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it.